This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Best Fiends and by Feels. My sponsors let me keep bringing you The Bladder Presents, so keep an ear out for more information later in the episode, and don't forget to use those promo codes to save yourselves some money. And now, the podcast.
You could be a real asshole, you know that? Turn asshole people listen to. If they don't, you make them.
If I had a nickel. From documentarian Liz Garbus comes the scripted screen take on Robert Kolker's great book on the yet-unsolved Long Island serial killer case and those it rippled outward from, Lost Girls. Is the film well done? A waste of time? Or maybe both? And on the eve of yet another Robert Durst trial, we're talking about the barely fictionalized All Good Things in the cold case section. Have events overtaken this one and made it superfluous? Was that Nick Offerman? And does this fit the definition of a Vanity Fair movie? Find out what happens when you socially distance yourself from the dialect coach. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 136. Not to be coming for Gabriel Byrne over here, but sometimes it's got to happen. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. I am joined once again by author, documentarian, and fellow Kolker fan club treasurer, Kevin Smokler. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming back. Let us get right into it with our most wanted section. This is the Netflix release, Lost Girls. I think it did have theatrical release of sorts. I know it was on the festival circuit as recently as 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Here is the case file from Netflix's press page. Quote, when 24-year-old Shannon Gilbert mysteriously disappears one night, her mother Mary, Academy Award nominee Amy Ryan, embarks on a dark journey that finds her face-to-face with hard truths about her daughter, herself, and police bias. Determined to find her daughter at all costs, Mary Gilbert retraces Shannon's last known steps, driving her own investigation to an insular, gated community near the desolate Outer Banks of Long Island. Her discoveries force law enforcement and the media to uncover more than a dozen unsolved murders of sex workers, young lives Mary will not let the world forget. Inspired by Robert Kolker's best-selling nonfiction book of the same name, and produced by Archer Gray's Anne Carey, end quote, it's also scripted by extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and vile Michael Verwey. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. My apologies to him. And also to some of the less than flattering things I'm going to say about how this is scripted. Kevin, keeping in mind that we both revere, I think is not too strong a word necessarily, Robert Kolker's book. And have historically been extremely impressed with not just how it handled these interconnected stories, but how it handled an overall story that had no ending. Mm-hmm. What did you think of this version of it? What did you think of Garbus's rendition of it overall?
So I should, Sarah, I should start by saying when I saw that Lost Girls was going to be on Netflix, having read the book, and granted 8 years ago, having read the book when it came out in 2012, I just assumed it was going to be like an 8-part limited series.
Right.
Because I thought that was the only format, 8 parts, 6 parts, what have you, that could take in a story not only with this many characters, but one that is still open-ended and ongoing. Mm. And as you know, because you've read and revered Lost Girls like I have, it is told from multiple points of view.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of its strengths is how much time and space it gives each of the families of the victims in this case. Mm. And yet, when I saw that it was a 1-hour and 35-minute fictionalization by a documentary filmmaker. Liz Garbus is a revered documentarian.
And I'm just going to interrupt you for a second to share with the listeners something that I learned recently. Her father, Martin, is an attorney who has been involved with a bunch of like notorious cases, and eventually on Best Evidence. That's at bestevidence.fyi. I am going to do a like list of all the sort of legendary cases locally that he's been involved with. I had no idea that that was true, and that's such an interesting insight into her work. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
I didn't know either, but I think that's really, really interesting. Her movies are often about people who are victimized by either outside forces that end up turning that victimization psychologically, internally upon themselves, he says clumsily while falling down the stairs. I remember when I saw it was a 1 hour and 35 minute fictionalization, I thought that was a little strange. Mm-hmm. And while I really appreciated, I think she made some great tonal choices. I think the casting is first rate. And I think, it does as well as it can. It feels a little shoehorned into this format. And I'm not blaming anybody involved. Sometimes, you know, you get what you. He who pays the piper, and sometimes the piper will only give you one tune, and you have to play it. So I understand this simply may not be the best story for a 90 minute fictionalized adaptation. And to me, that's the place its weaknesses show.
I think that's part of the problem. I do think that given that, I guess she was told, like, you're getting feature length, don't go over 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Like, and the fact is, it's an hour and 35 minutes, but like 6 minutes of that is credits and end chyrons that bring you up to date on various players in the story. Mm-hmm. But so this is short, but it still did not hold my interest terribly well, even though I think she did it the only way it can be done in this particular medium or genre, which is you have to slice off. That's not a good turn of phrase. Excuse me. You have to limit yourself to one section, one victim and her family. That seems to like frame the story best and like stand in for all the others. Unfortunately, this kind of goes against everything that made Kolker's work so different from what you usually get in this genre. Mm-hmm. So well reported and so good at listening and conveying the texture of all these people. And not like judging the systems that were trying to crush them, but not judging them for getting inevitably crushed. And it does do some things well, like the subtly. You're given a lot of sort of information about Mary, her relationship with Shannon, her oldest, who she put into foster care so that Shannon could get medications and therapy that Mary couldn't afford. And the fact that this is the lost girl, like this is the prodigal in this family unit, and the way the other sisters are contending with that on some level all the time, but also have a more realistic idea of who Shannon is, and they still love her. In our first clip in this section, Mary is listening to or watching an old like pageant or talent show performance from Shannon. Mm-hmm. And Cherie comes in and like volumes are communicated in not much dialogue and screen time. Here's clip two.
Sounds of the room.
Hey, Cherie. Shannon's coming for dinner.
There's just something about that, like Cherie's whole, like, we'll see.
Yeah, attitude. If you say so.
Yeah, that's Thomasin McKenzie as Cherie, and she is outstanding in this. And a lot of the acting is very good. I'm not entirely sure that the wig on Amy Ryan and the way it's deployed. But that moment and the moments in which the sisters' relationship amongst each other, even the absent one, is somehow present in this family dynamic at all times, is really well done, I thought, and subtly done and not asterisked and underlined.
Yeah, I think so. I think that may be one of the few places where we can give the screenplay adaptation credit. That's not fair of me to say. I don't know who we can give credit to, but there's something about the sparseness of those scenes and the way Amy Ryan and Thomasin McKenzie in particular convey silence. Thomasin McKenzie, whose face I recognize, but I had to look up her credits.
Same here.
Yeah. As soon as I remembered that she was the daughter in Leave No Trace, I said, oh, yes, of course. Because that's also that's another movie where, like, the space, this geographically speaking, is much bigger than the characters, like this one. Mm-hmm. And it's another movie where volumes have to be conveyed with silences. And so I think the casting of her, I'm not saying it was based on, you know, Without a Trace, but the casting of her is perfect in this movie because it really steers into her strengths.
Yeah. And she is a Kiwi, I believe, but she is not overmatched by whatever accent they're going for. Like, Gabriel Byrne is just like, I'm not getting paid enough to even try. And surely a cop must be basically Irish, right? It's New York. Like, well,
he's played a little bit in this movie like the character from In Treatment standing up instead of sitting down.
Yeah.
And it doesn't quite work. I think there's like the actor whose name I'm forgetting, but the actor who plays his kind of second in command, who's more overtly is the most overtly misogynist of the cops.
Oh, the Dean Winters? Mayhem?
Yeah. Yeah, Dean Winters is the kind of character actor who they should have in that role.
Right.
Someone who is not as recognizable, but has a way of bringing a supporting player to life.
Yeah, I think unfortunately Dean Winters, thanks to Mayhem and SVU and Oz and various things in which he's like almost inevitably playing either a cop or a robber, might have been too high profile.
It may, yeah, perhaps
for this, but I think you're right that they did need someone like, not a Brian Cox because he's also too high profile, but like a, I don't know, someone who tends to play a judge, like,
yeah,
Curatola, yes, or Peter McRobbie.
Right. Or I would even say that I would even say that sort of the non-obvious. I mean, if it's an adaptation, which it is, like the non-obvious role for a Suffolk County police commissioner, you know, like a sort of maybe a worn down version of a Paul Winfield when he was younger or someone
sure.
like that.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
I think silence is one of these things to just circle back to the thing I said a second ago. Like, silence is one of the things that this movie has going for it. And I think it's one of the things I think for the most part works in favor of the casting choices. You know, I kept thinking about Amy Ryan as Birdie in The Wire, mm-hmm. Where particularly in her sort of budding romance with McNulty. McNulty gets all of the flashy lines, and yet Amy Ryan completely holds her own on screen with Dominic West in those scenes. I think Amy Ryan is really good at being a present next to a much flashier, gabbier male character, which we don't have in this movie, but it just demonstrates that one of her strengths is being able to not say much and yet still have her own space within the frame and within the scene.
Well, and particularly given, like, this character is, you know, this is a character who is not afraid to make trouble, to call the media, to threaten the cops with the media, and vice versa. This is something that Kolker said about the real person mm-hmm. all the time, that she was incredibly abrasive, but that she was also on a mission, and that her life and her relationships with and among her children was complex. Like one of her children murdered her a few years ago. So yeah. Needless to say, lots going on.
Yeah. Unrelenting tragedy.
Just,
in this family.
I mean, truly. But with all of that said, like, I have so much respect for Liz Garbus as a filmmaker, for the screenwriter. Like, there were a lot of issues with the Ted Bundy thing, but I didn't really feel like the screenplay was one of them. It just was kind of maybe this misbegotten thing that didn't need to exist. Great respect for Amy Ryan. I think there are good performances here. There are also some not so great ones, but overall, this was not successful for me because I think that it's trying to split the difference in who it's for, and it doesn't work. And I also think there was no way to know that that was going to be true until you made the picture.
Yeah. Say more about that. Say more about the who's it's for part of what you just said.
Well, I think if you are trying to, if this is for everyone, then you have an issue. Like if you have people who read the book but don't really remember it that well, maybe this works. But if you have people who read the book, have followed Kolker's career as a result of reading this book, have consistently said this is the gold standard for writing A, sensitively about marginalized victims, particularly sex workers, and B, stories that are cases that are still not solved, where mm-hmm. you have to end the story even though it has no end, and who have, you know, paid attention to this case through other projects like Josh Zeman's series a few years ago on A&E. This will not be satisfying because you are familiar with the facts. And for people who know nothing about the case, haven't read the book, and are only kind of watching this because they like Amy Ryan, they read a good review, which I don't think this is getting. I haven't really read much. We'll put some links in the
show
notes.
Or they're Netflix true crime junkies. Yeah.
But yeah, and you know, Netflix is like, and what better time than our current moment in human history to just be like, well, it's not perfect, but you are home all day. Good luck to you.
Yeah.
That this is just, as I said, this is the most efficacious, practicable way to try to get your arms around even one corner of this story. Sorry for the mixed metaphor.
Yeah.
But I don't think it succeeds in that regard either, primarily because of a lot of like expositional / educational, one might say scolding dialogue that, while it is correct on the merits, is not how people talk, and especially not how these people talk.
Absolutely. That was the area where it showed that this was perhaps not the right format for this story. That's where that discrepancy was most glaring, in that when poor Amy Ryan, who really does her level best with this character and this screenplay, and her level best is better than 99% of actresses out there. But when the character has to sort of over explain how we got to this point in the plot or in the investigation, it's embarrassing. Like it's embarrassing for everybody involved, and not because they're doing a lousy job. But because these are all people who we expect to be doing a brilliant job, and they've been saddled with a task where it's very hard to be anything but.
She almost gets away with it too. That's the sad thing, that it's like this almost uncanny valley-esque situation where the closer the actors get to selling this very expositional dialogue, the more you feel the gap between how this realized character would speak to other characters who are already in the situation and do not need an update, and you know what you're getting on the screen. Speaking of getting away, let us get away from the topic just for a moment for a word from one of our sponsors, Best Fiends. I love talking about true crime, obviously, but I do like to take the occasional break from it. And when I feel like I need a mental palate cleanser, my go-to game lately is Best Fiends. And at this particular junction in human history, I think we could all use a fun, engaging respite from the news and a way to fill some at-home downtime. Best Fiends is perfect for that. Its puzzles are challenging, but not so tough to solve that you'll get discouraged. And it's made for adults, but it's not an adult quote-unquote game. It's a casual game that anyone can play involving bugs and slugs and fruit and flowers. And it's great for someone like me who uses it to pass the time in line at the post office or waiting for a pot of coffee to brew. You can switch it off midstream to deal with your package or your Java, and when you come back to it, it remembers where you were and drops you right back into gameplay. I could tell you I haven't cleared 100 levels since I talked to you about Best Fiends last time, but that would not be the truth. The game is just that rad, and it makes me feel like I'm accomplishing something to collect keys and gold bars. And you don't even need the internet to play it. If you're stuck without Wi-Fi, or very likely this week, your fam is hogging the bandwidth to stream movies, you can still play it anywhere you like. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thanks, Best Fiends. All right, back to this discussion, i.e. To Wit and Viz, you were talking about the spaces that Garbus and the actors and the screenplay are able to make and leave, which sometimes say more than the dialogue. Do you think that if this had been something more like the series Unbelievable, which was a true story that had been scripted but was given some episodes to let people be who they are and not bring in these lines and interactions that felt forced, do you think that would have addressed our concerns?
I think so. I mean, I will say that even in this format, which seems a bad fit for this story, I think Liz Garbus and team do a really excellent job with conveying, like we've said before, the beauty of Kolker's book is that it is told from the point from the point of view of the victims' families, which is a POV we rarely get in true crime writing. And in true crime writing, there's surprisingly more choices of point of view than in many other genres. Mm. You have victim, killer, investigator, family, community, and us as the reader. You know, that's a lot of different ways to tell the story. And in this one, where the choice has been made both in the book and in the movie adaptation of it to tell the story from the point of view of the victims' families, I think we're agreed that perhaps a 90-minute movie where there are at least 5 different sets of victims' families is not the exact right format for it.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, I always felt very drawn to Kim, who was another victim's sister, who also was a sex worker, I think, or at least was sort of continuing to do. She's played by Lola Kirk here. Mm-hmm. Kirk is outstanding. She doesn't get a whole lot to do. And I remember thinking a couple of times, like whenever she was speaking, this is someone who went back on Craigslist to try to draw the guy out. Mm-hmm. And this is both horrifically stupid and an almost tear-jerkingly sympathetic. Like, I just was like, what a tragic badass to try to do that.
Yeah, so true. And I think Lola Kirk gives a good enough performance with very little to do, that there's that. Yeah, like we could, were this the limited series of our dreams, there would have been a whole episode about her.
Yeah, exactly. That maybe it's the maybe it's like a Rashomon type of thing where it's like each episode is about a different family, and maybe you have some flexibility as to the length. That if there's one family that it's really 38 minutes, that's what you do. And if there's one that's an hour and 8 minutes, that's what you do. Or maybe some families get two episodes. Like, I just think that, and especially coming from a documentarian who, it's not that whatever unscripted or nonfiction makers of narrative don't sometimes like push to get a line that they need.
Absolutely.
But
I've done it myself.
I wasn't implying anything, but no. You know, like sometimes you need someone to locate you and you don't want to use a Chiron. Yeah. Like, sure, I get it. But I think that Garbus is probably used to like taking a ton of footage and then being like, it's going to be in here somewhere. And that's not necessarily how you shoot a scripted feature. Like, you can't just be like, oh, well, you know, so like we'll get it. Like, we'll just rewrite this book page with stage directions and we'll get it. Like, you can't do that. And that's how you end up with clip 3, which I'm sad to say is just one of like 6 exemplars of this not how people talk problem in the screenplay, clip 3.
Yeah.
At least it's on the news. I mean, people are aware of it.
Have you watched the news? It's all, he's a cop, he's a clammer, he's this, he's that. It's all him, him, him. What about our girls? Who's talking about them? And when they do, it's prostitute, hooker, sex worker, escort, never friend, sister, mother, daughter. They don't care. They blame them. And it's our job as mothers and sisters to make sure these girls are not forgotten.
I mean, this is what I was saying before. That's absolutely right. And that was the great gift of Kolker's work. But this declamation is not how you get that done in this genre. Like, it just felt very like plant feet deliver rhetorical thing. That, like, just putting swears in it doesn't make it any more organic sounding.
No, that's a Rotary Club speech masquerading as a conversation between two people.
And it's just really, it's too bad. And see also, all right, in the next clip, it's like the same thing on the cop side. I'm not saying they didn't think this, and I'm not saying they're not shitheads for thinking this. I'm saying they're cops who already know each other, and they wouldn't say this kind of thing, like, overtly. Clip 4.
Yeah.
Look, if she was still around, we would have found her by now. I mean, honestly, who spends this much time looking for a missing hooker?
I'm not sure I get it, Dean Winters.
Yeah.
Can you get more sneer on it? Like,
and the thing is, this Liz Garbus is a skilled enough filmmaker that the aesthetic and the look of this film is conveying the sentiment in both of those scenes already. The way the characters are framed at odd angles, the way this movie really preferences close-ups and vast, expansive panoramas over, you know, simple two shots and ordinary, what we would conceive of as sort of ordinary framing we'd see with our eyes. This is a movie about people. The aesthetic of it says that people are being treated unfairly. They're not given the information they need. They're not seeing the full extent of the story. And sometimes they're willingly closing themselves off.
Well, and in this particular scene that we just heard a clip from, Captain Gabriel Byrne is sitting in the dark, and actually Dean Winters has a line right before that he's like, do you think you're going to find her from looking at her medical records? And you could have just stopped right there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because he's absolutely right in everything that he's saying. Like, you aren't going to find her from that. She would have turned up if she were alive. And also, people don't spend that much time on dead and missing sex workers. He could have been nicer and more proactive in the way he phrased it, but this was, and still is, I'm sure. Although I think the police are probably a little more, have found a way to spin it, but I think this is still the reality. But, and, you know, he's sitting, like, he's in his office in the dark. Like, you know, it's already done. The work was already done. I also wanted to mention, and there's a shot of this that will be in the visual aids, which you can find on Twitter at Blotter Presents over the coming days. Mary's jobs is that she runs a backhoe. Mm-hmm. I think. I don't know big machines.
It's essentially characterized by her wearing an orange vest with reflector stripes and a hard hat. And we don't know much more than that.
And she's in the cab of it, and it's pulling up a huge, like, involved, complex tree root. And the, like, groaning, cracking, like, painful sound it makes coming out of the earth is really nice. That's really nice work. And it's like 2 seconds. And it's like, you know, Liz Garbus is not unaware that this is a visual medium and that a lot of the things that Bob Kolker would have to take a page and a half to do, she can do in 2 seconds. But it just was a pity that I was like, I think there is a worthwhile, compelling, scripted version of this acted by these people. Maybe swap out Gabriel Byrne for someone who's not, like, with one foot out the door to the bank, but like, more or less, like, this is a quality product that isn't living up to itself. So I am not going to recommend it. Read the book instead, or read the New York Magazine articles by Bob Kolker, which we will link in the show notes. But this is, I think, even though it's kind of short, it's still not a good use of the time, in my opinion.
This movie is worth seeing as an investment in the careers of the work and the filmography of the people involved. It's totally worth seeing, because you want to see everything that Liz Garbus and Amy Ryan and Thomasin McKenzie have ever done. That is a good use of your viewing time. And you want to read everything that Robert Kolker has ever done. That is a good use of your time as well. I think I liked it more than you, but I totally agree that this simply may not be the best cinematic manifestation of this story. I think everybody makes a noble effort, but I feel like something is not quite right in that. This is not quite the right way to tell this story.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you at Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, like I said. And you can also call the Blotter Presents tip line, 919-75-CRIME. You can also text that number, What a Time to Be Alive, if you really liked it, if you're on the fence about watching it. I'd always love to hear from you. But yeah, this one, I mean, it had Kevin Corrigan in it, and I still can't tell you to watch it.
Yeah, and Miriam Shore, who I would watch, you know, who I would watch peeling a potato. So,
For sure. All right, moving on to our cold case section, for which I think we're going to be saying a lot of similar things, but for different reasons. We are talking about All Good Things, a movie from 2010. Here is the case file from the IMDb. Quote, a love story and murder mystery based on the most notorious unsolved murder case in New York history. Parenthetical, not really, but okay. The original screenplay uses newly discovered facts, court records, and speculation as the foundation for a story of family, obsession, love, and loss. This is, of course, the Ryan Gosling, Kirsten Dunst, Robert Durst picture. He's called David Marks in this, but seriously, the fig leaf name changes are hilarious to me. Like, Jeanine Pirro yeah. is Janice Rizzo. Like, oh, I don't know who they could be talking about. They even right, cast someone right. who That's looks like her.
The three Italian names I'm familiar with, yeah.
I mean, this one, I hadn't seen it. And it's also worth noting that, you know, after The Jinx, anything about Robert Durst that came before it was sort of irrelevant. But Andrew Jarecki, who co-directed
The Jinx, kind of erased the, like, iconoclastically, like all the old church murals, like, erased the history of what came before.
Yeah, that there's this is the palimpsest, like, underneath is this, which he did before the documentary version. And Kirsten Dunst said that Durst, like, came to the set, and that Durst, I think everyone agrees, did watch this and reached out to Jarecki about it. And with all of that said, this is another one where I'm not entirely sure who it's for at this point. Like, I think events have overtaken it, and it's no longer necessary. But aside from that, I thought it was well made and well done. It's just, like, superfluous. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting in that, we in retrospect largely see it as, you know, the same way we unfortunately now view the American president as warm-up exercises that Aaron Sorkin did for The West Wing.
Right.
And the same way we view Homicide, Life on the Street as throat clearing David Simon did before he made The Wire,
right.
Both of which is unfair to those first projects. I think it may be fair to this one because Andrew Jarecki was a documentary filmmaker before he was given a narrative crack to make this movie, which is really like a documentary with actors and thinly veiled pseudonyms.
Yeah.
It leads into The Jinx, which happens 5 years later, and is a better, more appropriate telling of this story.
Yeah. I mean, there are some other issues with it, like I said, but I will say that, first of all, pretty much everyone is in this. And, like, Kristen Wiig? What? Furthermore...
With an incredible sunglasses game.
Oh my God. An incredible sunglasses game. She's like the, I think, either sister-in-law or bestie or both of the Kirsten Dunst character, Katie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the point in the story where Katie is considering leaving David Marks, giant air quotes, and he is squeezing her financially with the credit cards just to sort of show her who's in control. And their credit card has just been declined at some Ladies Who lunch spot. Kristen Wiig has the following withering note for some ladies who are staring and whispering at them. I will be saving this for permanent use on my soundboard. Clip 5.
What the hell are you looking at? Eat your salad.
Eat your salad.
Yeah, it can reverberate in so many different directions. I mean, I don't often notice set decorative elements like this one, but this appears to be the only restaurant in Manhattan because there's at least three scenes filmed there.
Yes, because they have that playbill. Yeah.
Yes, you can see framed playbills on the back. I wondered if it was kind of a down market version of Sardi's, but
or Elaine's. I feel like they use that actual table in Manhattan.
Okay,
but
so I
maybe it was just
I don't
the feeling
remember
of it being
when
crowded.
Elaine's closed. I feel like Elaine's closed around this time, but I don't know for sure. But yeah. The set decoration seems to imply that every restaurant in Manhattan, or really that either this is the only restaurant in Manhattan, or every one of them has framed playbills on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, it can't be like on Cabaret Row; they all have to. They'd only be playbills involving Liza Minnelli, perhaps, but it's not unique. But the movie seems to, it's actually unclear, and I wanted to ask your opinion on this. I think that it's possible that the movie wants us to feel sorry for let's just call him Durst because that's who it is, feel sorry for Durst, or at least be able to invest in Ryan Gosling as Durst at the center of the picture by giving him these serious, horrible daddy issues and having witnessed his mother's gory suicide at the age of 7. Like, I'm not saying that that doesn't have an effect and that that isn't a slightly mitigating factor to someone's later disordered behavior, but it's kind of unclear what the movie wants us to do with the information. Was that your impression?
Yeah. On the one hand, it can feel like a very expensively produced Lifetime movie about, I'm married to a misogynist asshole. And that could simply be that I think, even though her character, literally disappears 2/3 of the way into the film, Kirsten Dunst's character is given more emotional range. And I think she's the person who delivers the best performance in this movie.
Yeah, she does a really gorgeous job. There's a scene where she and her mom are at a restaurant once again. I don't think it was actually this one. Could have been. And it becomes clear that Durst Sr. expects to split, this real estate gazillionaire expects them to split the bill. And it's like a fancy place. I mean, it was the 70s, $39.50 a person for lunch is not a fucking joke anyway. And she is looking at him with this confusion that is tinting into loathing. It was hard to capture in a screenshot, but I tried. She does really well. I know some people are anti-Dunst, but she is very good in this, very sweet and sympathetic. And the scene when she discovers what has become of Ivan the Husky is really, it's really something. Was she nominated for anything for this?
I don't believe so. But, this movie compelled me to sort of look at her past work. And the thing, and I like a lot of her movies and her performances in them. Not 100%, but I like a lot of them. And I think the thing that really speaks to me is, listen, it is very hard to find a Kirsten Dunst performance or film that where the role is not somehow about her beauty.
Yeah.
And however, the characters and the way she plays them always kind of see that as by the by. They don't really lean into it. I mean, maybe Marie Antoinette is an exception. But for the most part, it seems rather extraneous to the characters themselves. Whereas if you take one of her contemporaries, and I don't mean to single this contemporary out because I think she's had quite a lot of redeeming work in her 40s. But like most of Heather Graham's filmography is not only about characters who are beautiful, but characters who lean into being beautiful.
Yeah.
Where there's not much else to them but being beautiful. And I think Kirsten Dunst has very smartly taken roles and played them in a way that that's not the only thing we focus on. And that is I think this may be one of the best examples of that in her work.
Well, and there's also this essential girlishness often. So it was going to be interesting to me, having really thought the world of her work in the second season of Fargo. Can this person turn the corner from these roles that she's been in, which is cute and daffy, crushable, but kind of girlish and dizzy and not to be taken that seriously. And there's a lot of heavy shit happening here. Like, she's being grabbed by the hair and hauled out of a family party. She's being stood up at her pregnancy termination. This is not Bring It On, the adult years. So, I mean, look, I love Bring It On. Don't get me wrong. It's just,
so do I. Absolutely.
Different feel. So, but it's really interesting to watch her. And this was 10 years ago. So, I think she's not necessarily given credit for or thought of for parts like this. And there are a lot of people doing things sort of, not around the margins of this, but it's interesting to me, particularly like living with an actor and seeing choices being made in an unshowy way about what a character is doing. In the clip I'm about to play, and this is why I asked about the where the audience's sympathies are supposed to be with this, with the Durst Sr., that Durst is asking his father, why are you like this about my mother's death? Why didn't you take me inside? Why didn't you try to protect me? And the line from Durst Sr. at the end is something that I want to talk about more. Clip 6.
I told the nanny to take you inside.
Is that true? You left me out there to watch.
I saw her there, you know. On the driveway. I thought she was sleeping. So I tried to wake her up. I touched her head.
This is morbid. Give me that.
How come you didn't just pick me up, Dad?
If she saw you standing there, she wouldn't jump.
I thought if she saw you standing there, she wouldn't jump. And you can see Frank Langella sort of, as Durst Sr., kind of calculating, do I give him this information and make him feel worse about the fact that he bet wrong on his mother's willingness to protect her children from seeing her die? And this is someone who has consistently treated Durst like the trifler that he has been, and is cheap and is distant. And yet watching this character sort of sort through, like there's that lizard brain flicker of compassion. That's like, do I want him to have this information or should he know what the calculation was? It was a nice bit of business, from a character that was drawn as a cartoon for most of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of good scenes in this movie, and there's a lot of, and it's rather overstuffed with talent. Mm. Some of it, people not giving their best performance. I mean, Ryan Gosling gives essentially this performance in Drive, and it works better.
Gosh, you're so right.
Then gives it a place where it does not work as well. But this is for someone who has the range that Ryan Gosling is. We've seen this performance before in better contexts, and in better movies. But I think, there's a real surfeit of talent in this movie. I think Lily Rabe, or is it Rob? How do you pronounce her?
Because Lily Broccoli Rob. I actually, interviewed her, years and years ago when I was working at Yahoo, and I think it's Lily Rabe.
Rabe. Okay.
And I would have watched an entire movie that was just like 33 short films about, quote, Deborah, quote, Lehrman. It's obviously Susan
me
Berman.
Too.
She looks amazing. We'll get into it. Before we do, a word from another sponsor, Feels. Do you experience stress or have anxiety, chronic pain, or trouble sleeping at least once a week? You are not alone, especially right now. Many of us do. Even before the current news cycle accelerated, I was a nationally ranked worrier with a long to-do list spanning multiple sheets in Excel, which could make it tough to get things done or to turn my brain off at the end of the day. Enter Feels. What is Feels? Feels, with an A, is premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep. Feels reduces stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness naturally. and it's super easy to take. Just put a few drops of Feels under your tongue and feel the difference in minutes. New to CBD? No problem. Finding the right dose for you is important, and everyone's is different, so if you're unsure or just want a real human to talk you through it, Feels offers a free CBD hotline to help guide your personal experience. My experience with Feels is that it let me focus more calmly on what needed to be done and get it done with less spinning about deadlines or headlines. And when you find your right dose, you'll also find that there's no high, no hangover, and no addiction. Joining the Feels community means getting Feels delivered to your door every month, particularly handy these days when your door may be as far as you're able to go. But becoming a member also saves you money, and you can pause or cancel anytime you like. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by visiting feels.com/blotter to get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/blotter to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/blotter. Thanks so much, Feels. And thank you so much, Construction Next Door, for locating right next to my office. Sorry about the bandsaw, everyone. I guess not everybody is socially distancing themselves from work. Anyway, getting back to the casting of Ryan Gosling for a second, I thought he did a good job with this, but I think he's just too physically big.
Yeah.
I think he was not quite right and played it a little too much like a, hey, oh, tough guy. Like, not that that wasn't Durst's accent, but didn't quite work for me. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, and you can see it very, I mean, yes, of course, he's 30 years older or significantly older, maybe even more than that, than Ryan Gosling. When we see Durst in The Jinx 5 years later. But Durst seems like a sort of small, callow little man. He seems to be someone who wants to take up more space in a room but is unable to.
I think that's about right. I, as great as I thought the casting of Lily Rabe was, I struggled often with just how much taller Gosling is than, like, usually most of the other people in the scene, and I didn't feel like that quite worked. I did think the old age makeup, like the aging, was okay. It wasn't too bad.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, here's a clip in which Lily Rabe's Susan Berman / Deborah Lerman is having a meltdown and doing everything to illustrate how she in real life probably got killed for blackmailing Durst about what she knew about what he'd done / helping him do what he'd done. This is every way to illustrate something like this that Lost Girls didn't quite have time to do. I did cut this clip down a bit because there's a bunch of just visual business involving Durst putting away some ammo, but you'll get the gist. Here's clip 7.
Yeah.
It was his reporter, and now a cop's calling from New York every 5 minutes.
And I want to be there for you, David. I do, but
I have my own problems now. I had an accident. It's nothing serious, but my car needs some repairs. As you know, life in Los Angeles without one is impossible.
Let's go.
Then,
Lulu, let's go. Oh, fuck.
I hate myself for asking, but I need more money.
I don't know if this record. Why are you avoiding me? I've always been there for you. I've been a good friend to you. Don't you fucking...
And then he goes back to doing dishes in drag. Sure.
Right. Then
Just thought, like, there's also, you can't see it, but she's towing her little purse dogs past the car, which, like, it doesn't need some repairs. It's fucking totaled. And it's been sitting there rusting for a while. It's really quite something. I just was struck by the elegance and understatedness of how the script was like, this is why he feels she has to be subtracted from the narrative, possibly because they didn't want to get sued, but probably because it's just elegantly done. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it's one of the, I had a couple of moments watching this movie for the second time in prep for us talking that I was like, you know, given that we now, you know, obviously when this movie was made, we didn't know that The Jinx was coming 5 years later, but like, I wonder if, and I understand why Andrew Jarecki, you know, having been given the go-ahead to make a movie about the story of Robert Durst, felt like he had to include possibly all three murders he's responsible for. In retcon, I totally wonder if this movie would work just fine if it was only about the disappearance. Does the sort of him living in Galveston in drag and being neighbors with Philip Baker Hall, does it feel like a fourth leg on this stool?
Well, and I mean, maybe I did like the framing device with God, what is the actor's name? Help me. Holling.
Who?
From Northern Exposure as his attorney. Barry Moordock? Does that sound right?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I mean, he's played an attorney and a judge a gazillion times on Law &
Right.
Order.
I don't remember specifically, yeah, but yes,
I'm pretty sure it's Barry
Moordock.
It's unmistakably him. I think he finally actually shows up on screen, like, 12 minutes from the end, but I mean, again, stuffed with talent, this movie. I think maybe it would have worked better stopping it there, and certainly various Law and Order ripped from the headlines adaptations did this in, you know, 44 minutes of screen time or whatever. But I also absolutely would have watched a separate film. Like, this could have been a limited series also. Like, show us Susan. Yeah. Show us Malvern Bump. Is that his name?
Yeah.
In this?
Way more colorful name than the character's actual name. I believe the actual person's name was Morris Black.
Yeah, but, I think that's right. But I mean, Malvern Bump. Like, what a good time they must have done sending these names to legal. Like, is this different enough? How about now? How about now?
Yeah.
That,
I mean,
whole part of the story, though, felt kind of like, well, now we have to start at the beginning with this. And that I was like, is he also going to shoplift the sandwich? Which I think that hadn't happened yet, so that's not in there. But it's like the actors find a way to sell it, and the script, even though it, like, the traditional sort of like first, second, third act, they're not spaced out necessarily the way you expect. Gosling is miscast, probably. It's still kind of works. Like, you know, they're out like shooting together, and there's Gosling looming over Philip Baker Hall in what is basically a lady's pirate shirt and like fingernail polish. I mean, it's kind of a nice shirt. I kind of want the shirt. And then,
I mean, it's,
sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's very elegantly told, and there is perhaps an argument from a plot point of view that if you don't have the additional two murders, you essentially have a musty old story that has been repeated so many times in America, like going back to Theodore Dreiser's American Tragedy, like the story of a rich guy erasing a problematic, you know, wife who comes from modest circumstances. Like,
yeah. There's also the argument to be made that this particular story's power comes from the cumulative nature of Durst's continued alleged, I guess we have to say, offenses.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's something to,
like, just one is a who cares her, but like all of it together is like, Jesus fucking Christ, this guy. So,
and there's, I give it credit that like there is enough to this story that there actually is sort of propulsion to move you from point to point, because as we've said, like, Gosling's performance really isn't enough for that, another movie that is sort of, you know, essentially a filmed Vanity Fair or Dominic Dunn article, Foxcatcher, is a movie that has exactly the opposite problem. It has a great performance and no plot to drive it forward. Like, it has it has Steve Carell as you've never seen Steve Carell, and yet there's very little to that movie other than Steve Carell.
Yeah, that is kind of the log line. I'm just going to play one last clip, which is the moment at which Philip Baker Hall sort of opens a door to, like, a long hallway that you wish the movie had time to go down about this character's, all the hallways he didn't walk down. It's a little hard to explain, but he just, in a single line at the end of this clip, breaks your heart, basically. Here's clip 8.
Yeah.
You know, you wear all that shit for anyway.
What?
The girl stuff. You like that kind of thing?
No. I guess, I just kind of want to disappear for a little while. What about you? Is that why you came out here?
Me, I am. I disappeared a long time ago.
Oof.
Yeah. A lot going on there.
Yeah, you said a mouthful, Philip Baker Hall. And speaking of three named actors, whose names start with Philip, I think I've latched onto who should have played that police chief. Pity he's no longer with us.
Oh, absolutely.
Mr. Hoffman.
Yeah, that would have been great.
Yeah, may you rest.
Yeah. I you know, to go back to how overstuffed with talent this movie is, you probably had the same reaction I did when you saw Nick Offerman without a beard, right?
Yeah. It's very, very strange. And playing this sort of, like, not feckless, but, like, he's definitely goofier than you're used to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Everyone looks very, very young. Because it was 10 years ago.
Did you catch 5 minutes of William Jackson Harper from The Good
Place? Yes, Chidi! As Daniel Patrick Moynihan's aide, who's like, well, she sent us this stuff. And he's like, that's a family matter. Like, you think something's going to happen with that because it's Chidi. Come on, guys. No.
Yeah. My wife and I both stopped for a minute and said, wait a minute. We know who's playing that aide.
I was like, what the hell? Oh, my God. It's not Barry Mordock at all, by the way. I just found it in my notes. The actor's name is John Cullum. He plays defense attorney turned judge Barry Mordock on Law & Order. And he played Holly Finicore on Northern Exposure. Thank you for coming to my John Cullum talk.
That's right. And I feel like it was a similar, hey, it's that guy who played the oily younger brother of Ryan Gosling.
Yeah. I looked it up. Like, I think he's one of those that, like, he is just a, hey, it's that guy who. I didn't notice anything that jumped out at me. But it was definitely like, you know, he was in a Law & Order. He was in a Homicide. He was in that, like, Venn.
Yeah,
in The Sopranos, he's like bystander number two. Like, they all pulled out of the same casting pool. I, as someone who was reasonably familiar with this case and covered the Jinx closely when it was on, I found this very interesting to watch, just to see what they would do with it and how they were going to do things starring these, like, famous people who I also already know. But it does... like, it does stop short of all the facts that we have on the ground. And if you aren't familiar with anything about Durst and didn't watch The Jinx, I'm not sure whether this is a worthwhile rental, but it is full of interesting, good performances, and it is not boring. Like, my mind did wander away from Lost Girls a couple of times, and it did not wander away from this.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to bone up, if you want to bone up or learn something about the Robert Durst alleged three murders, The Jinx is a better use of your time, even though it's six times as long as this.
Well, yeah. I would actually like watch both. Why not? But if you only have time for one.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
I guess you should watch All Good Things because it's shorter, but like The Jinx, I don't know. If you want to get up to speed on what's really going on, The Jinx.
I will say though, just from a film fan point of view, this is going to sound like an absurd comparison because the movie I'm about to say, The Princess Bride, is a much better movie than this. But one of the things that is as fun about The Princess Bride, in addition to just what we already think is fun about The Princess Bride, is seeing what became of all of the actors in it after and because of The Princess Bride. The Princess Bride looks like, you know, it's like a freshman year photograph of, you know, what would later be, you know, Claire Danes' boss on Homeland, and, you know, and Cher Horowitz's teacher in Clueless, and, you know, and every interesting thing Cary Elwes has done, and, you know, the president on House of Cards.
Uh-huh.
I think there's a similar pleasure in this movie. It's some people who, you know, Ryan Gosling has done better work. I'm not sure Kirsten Dunst has. She's really delivering the goods here. But it's a lot of fun to see a lot of the younger people in this movie early in their careers and what became of them later.
I absolutely agree. I'm going to go ahead and recommend it. I mean, I understand if like you don't want to spend money on it, but like it's only $3 on Amazon if you have that. And if you are following the case and want to, like, the case has been put on pause because of COVID-19, duh. But
yeah.
If you want to sort of reacquaint yourself so you can follow along with what exactly is being prosecuted here in real life, I don't think this is a bad primer, honestly. And it's like, it's very handsome to look at. There's some excellent performances, and I think Gosling is the like best Gosling he can be. This just shouldn't be a Gosling part, I think.
No, it really shouldn't. I think he's done this exact performance better in other of his films. This movie, like, worth saying, this movie is also part of a genre I really enjoy, which is like rich people doing shitty things to each other. And like, my interest in that is pretty prurient, but like I enjoy, you know, other examples of this genre, like, you know, Reversal of Fortune and all of the miniseries made from Dominic Dunn articles.
Yeah.
And, you know,
various sort of documentaries, many of them on PBS, actually, but adapted from Texas Monthly articles.
Yeah.
Which was a suggestion made by Best Evidence readers. There's an open thread all about this. If you have ideas about things like, you know, DuPonts and Dursts and Trumps and like all the biopic material adapted from these back of the book Vanity Fair type cases, we would love to hear about them. And there will be a link to that in the show notes. And there will be a link to this movie.
I'm so glad by that, by the way, one of your readers chose Bernie.
Yes. Because
I think that's not only a great piece of journalism, but a great movie too.
Yeah. Jack Black's best performance by far. Even if you're like, I hate that guy, same. This movie will change your whole attitude for sure.
Very much so.
Well, Kevin, thanks for coming back. I'm glad I got to talk through our complicated feelings about these two features.
Me too, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me again.
All right, before we close out.
What the hell are you looking at? Eat your salad.
Kevin Smokler, where can listeners find you and your work?
I'm on Twitter at Weege, W-E-E-G-E-E, and on the traditional internets at Kevin Smokler, SMOKLER.com.
Outstanding. Thanks again for coming back. Next time on The Blotter Presents, Nada Nunca. It'll be birthday week, so there will be no new episodes. Enjoy the archives, and there may be some Blotter briefs, teehee briefs, to tide you over until the end of the month. If you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Once again, that'll be free all this week and probably beyond to all subscribers, and we are taking pitches, so sign up today. Today's episode was sponsored by Best Fiends and by Feels. Download Best Fiends in the Apple and Google Play app stores and visit feels.com, promo code Blotter, to take advantage of that 50% off plus free shipping offer. My guest has been Kevin Smokler. Like he said, he's on Twitter at Weege. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.